right, so we are studying now from the book of Ezra, and we were finishing up some of the things that were left over in chapter 2, that lengthy chapter that we read. And so last week we were we took the opportunity to look at some of the things that the Lord says about those ones that are called the given ones, the Nethinims, that we read about there in Ezra chapter 2 in the latter part of it, that were counted with Solomon's servants as one of the distinct groups that returned to Israel with the captives, along with all the others, numbering almost 50,000. But they were enumerated according to the places there in Judah where they had come from, and by their numbers there through the chapter, which is why it's so long. But these are the ones that did come back from Babylon, as all of the Israelites were given the opportunity to do so. These are the ones that clearly understood that the Lord's work needed to be done and the temple needed to be rebuilt, and that's what they were commissioned to do. And so that's what they had chosen as the work that they would do. So even though the vast majority of these people would have not known the land of Israel that the captives had left 70 years before, they still went there because that was God's will, and so they're the ones that return. We also saw mention of the priests, and the last thing that we had noted there in our study there of chapter 2 was how the ones that were not could not prove their lineage by the genealogical records, indicating that it obviously at some point some of those records were lost, and it would certainly seem likely that that could have happened at the time during the siege and thereafter when Jerusalem fell and the people were, or even before that when the captives were taken. I mean, whatever records, they may not have been able to take all of them, and then whatever was left, there could have been some that were not preserved after the fall of Jerusalem when the city was destroyed. So there were some of the ones who were of the families of the priests that could not prove their and sought their register. Among those that were reckoned by genealogy, it told us in verse 62 of Ezra chapter 2, but they were not found, therefore they were as polluted, put from the priesthood. So even though they could have said, well, I know my father who brought me up and who his father was, it wasn't that long ago in time from where these records had been preserved, but the fact is, that was required because only the sons of Aaron could be priests, and we can see the strictness of that that requirement, that when God put that there, that if they weren't the sons of Aaron, they couldn't be priests, and so there couldn't be any mistake about that. They couldn't. There was not going to be any guessing or taking someone's word for it. It was going to have to be proven by the records, and when that could not be done, then they could not serve as priests. So a reminder again of the authority of God and the fact that when God authorizes something, it has to be done his way fully, and there are no other ways about it. And when we see that, well, one of the applications that we mentioned last week was with those who believe in that doctrine of premillennialism, that where they think Jesus is going to come back and set up a 1,000-year earthly reign from Jerusalem, and they think the physical temple is going to be rebuilt in Jerusalem as part of that, and the Jewish religion is going to be reinstituted with when they're ready to receive Christ back. There's no way that can be done. There are no records preserved, and there's who on this earth today can prove generation by generation and trace themselves back to Aaron, the high priest, the brother of Moses. I mean, there are no such records. So there's no way that the priesthood of the Old Testament could ever be reinstituted. That being the case, who could ever go into the holy place in the temple where only the priests were allowed to go? How could you ever have the Day of Atonement? I mean, you couldn't have any of those, any of the things that were commandments of God under the law of Moses that were specific to the temple and the works of the priests, which there were many such commandments, that none of that can ever be reinstituted. And who is the one that has seen to it that that can't be done? Who was the one that took that out of the way and very obviously did not have his will for that to ever be able to be reconciled or reconstituted, whatever, to be brought up again? Yeah, I mean, it was not God's will for that to be done. It was God's will that Christ fulfill that and that that be taken out of the way. And so that was, when did that come to an end, by the way? When was the final ending of the priesthood under the Old Testament? When did the Old Testament religion, as it was founded, when did that go out of existence, never to return? Well, as a religious authority, that's true. Yet, that was still the, for the Jews at that time, it still served as their civil law for a period of time, because there was still a high priest around. But when did that end in that way, where there was no longer a nation of Israel as it was under the Old Testament? The Israel of the Bible, when did that come to an end? Yeah, 70 AD, when Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans. That was when all of that ended. And obviously at that time, they were scattered, many died at that time. But the Jews were scattered. There weren't many left in the land. But what happened to all the records and everything else? The temple was leveled and everything to do with it was gone. And that's it. I mean, in what is called Israel today and what you see on the map, I mean, it's the same geographical location, but it's not the same nation that was of the Bible. Even though there's still a lot of people around today that call themselves Christians, most of the ones that call themselves evangelical Christians are very much tied into believing those doctrines and that Israel is going to be revived, and that there's going to be a temple and a priesthood and a millennial reign of Christ on this earth, which none of which is going to come to pass. But this passage in Ezra chapter 2 is one that shows how that cannot be, because God's authority had to be, I mean, it was followed strictly. So when there was no absolute proof that they were descended from Aaron, according to those records, by generation, then they couldn't do it. They were put out of the priesthood. So that was to ensure that what God said, that only the descendants of Aaron could serve as priests, there would be no mistakes. They had to prove that, and only the ones that God authorized could be in that position. We get to chapter 3, And as we read in chapter 3 here in the book of Ezra, he begins in verse 1 saying, "And when the seventh month was come, and the children of Israel were in the cities, the people gathered themselves together as one man to Jerusalem." All right, so they had come there to the land of Israel. They came to their places, all those cities that were named in chapter 2. So they have repopulated Judea. Now they all, of course, when repopulated, not to the same extent, not with the numbers that had once been there. It was this was a remnant that had come back, but they were there, and so this people, the 50,000 that he roughly that he had mentioned there and gone through in chapter 2, these are the ones he's talking about here. So in the seventh month after they've returned, they were gathered together as one man to Jerusalem, because it's going to be time to do the work that they were back there to do. I mean, they couldn't just go back there, go to their towns, rebuild their houses in those cities that they came from or that their forebears came from, and then that be the end of it. I mean, they would have to do that, but what was job number one and what was central to their going back from what God had prophesied about Cyrus and what we saw at the beginning of the book with what Cyrus wrote as a proclamation? Rebuilding the temple. So they come to Jerusalem. And so verse 2 here, Ezra chapter 3 verse 2 says, "Then stood up Jeshua the son of Jozadak and his brethren the priests, and Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel and his brethren, and builded the altar of the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings thereon, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God." We have mentioned here about these two individuals that served as the leaders of the people that of the captives that returned. We have first mention of them back in the beginning of chapter 2, verse 2. These ones who, the captives, it says, which came with Zerubbabel, and then Joshua is the next name mentioned. So Zerubbabel and Joshua, these are two individuals that we read about prominently here in the book of Ezra. They were the two men that were the leaders of the captives that returned. We also read about them in the books of Haggai and Zechariah, the prophets who were with the people at this time. When you're trying to, we have a lot of prophets and books of the prophets in the Old Testament. It's helpful if we can get to a point where we have an understanding, a picture of where those prophets fit in their time. As far as the history of Israel, and that's something we've attempted to do as we've gone through these books, as we've seen these prophets. So for example, with the major prophets, those are a bit easier, since there are how many in the section of the books of the Old Testament that are categorized as the major prophets, how many books are there? Five. How many prophets are represented by those, major prophets are represented by those large books? The books of the so-called major prophets, that's Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, and Daniel. That's five books, but four prophets, because there wasn't a prophet Lamentations. That's the book of Lamentations, which was inspired through which prophet? One of those four, that the other four books, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel, where the names of those prophets that God inspired the words through. Which of those four prophets major prophets did God use or inspire to write the book of Lamentations?
Jeremiah.
What was he lamenting? That book is a lamentation about the destruction of Jerusalem. So Jeremiah was the one who was there for that. So when we think about the major prophets, for example, just in the history we've been through recently in our study of the kings of Judah, I mean, from the time when the northern kingdom of Israel fell, which major prophet was around at that time with the fall of the northern kingdom and then was with the king of Judah who was left on his own after that northern kingdom fell, when the southern kingdom was left as the sole remaining kingdom and of all the Israelites that were left in the land? Is Isaiah the prophet? And which king is he associated with mostly, that we see his work with so prominently? And that was Hezekiah, the king of Judah. So Isaiah, he came before the other ones because the other three major prophets were contemporaries of each other. I mean, they lived at the same time, that is Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. But those three were in different places with different works that God had them to do. Though they lived on the earth, their lifetimes overlapped. Jeremiah was in Jerusalem, and he stayed there with that basket of evil figs all the way until the end and the fall of Jerusalem. And we even looked at what happened with him after that, with the remnant that was left there, when we were looking at our study of what happened to the children of Israel when there were no more kings, and there were those few that were left in the land of Israel that Jeremiah stayed with. And where did they end up going against God's will, where they perished? Egypt. So Jeremiah warned them not to go there, and they didn't listen to him, and they went there, and God told them that's where they would be destroyed. As far as the ones that were left in the land of Israel at that time, that was the end of their story. So it left only the captives in Babylon, and which major prophet was with the ones over there that God used to work with the remnant that was left that eventually repented, and we're now seeing those ones in their return here in the book of Ezra. It was Ezekiel the prophet that worked with them over in Babylon. And Daniel was also in Babylon, but he was in the palace as part of the royal court. And then when it transitioned over to the Persian Empire through Cyrus, all the way through the time of Darius the Great, many years later, many kings later, Daniel was there through all of it. So from Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, until Darius, the king of Persia, that, by the way, he's going to be the one that ends up decreeing that what Cyrus decreed that we read about at the beginning of the book of Ezra, that it be honored. And that we're going to see that in chapter 6 of the book of Ezra, Lord willing. So Darius is going to come up there. The work of the temple is going to get stopped for a while until it's finished. So then Darius is going to be the one who's going to search the records and then give the decree that what Cyrus had said would be followed, because the Persians had a rule. One of their rules was about their rules was what? Yes, one of their rules was that their rules couldn't be changed. When there was a royal law made, that was it. They could not undo it. So what Cyrus proclaimed, that's going to be relevant to this situation with the rebuilding of the temple, because when their enemies succeed in getting the work stopped on the temple, it's going to go back to that. What Cyrus decreed is part of the Persian records, and that being a royal decree, it could not be undone by anybody else. And Darius is going to be the one that's going to have that searched out, and when it's found, he's going to proclaim, "This has got to be finished," and it is. So that's going to have a very, very much a relevant part in what we read all the way through chapter 6 here in this book of Ezra. But that's when it gets finished. So these different prophets tie into these different historical points in with Israel, as we see with the majors. With the minor prophets, it's the same. Many of the minor prophets were contemporaries of those major prophets. I mean, Hosea was around at the time of Isaiah, for example. But two of those minor prophets that we have books of that are here in this time with these two men that we're reading about in the beginning of Ezra 3, Zerubbabel and Joshua, Haggai and Zechariah. And so we read about those same two, Zerubbabel and Joshua, in the books of Haggai and Zechariah, because it those books, entirely the book of Haggai, it's very short, two chapters, it's about the rebuilding of the temple. Haggai is there with them. God uses Haggai and Zechariah to encourage the people to keep building, to do the work, in spite of the opposition. This was a great work of God. Was Satan going to be willing to allow that work to go on with no opposition and no discouragement, no persecution? No, and of course he can't do anything on his own. And so was it God's will that that work of his be done by his servants without any persecution? When is it God's will that his servants have no opposition, have no hindrances, no obstacles, no temptations, no persecutions to go through as part of their service to him? I mean, that it's God's will that we have to face those have trials on our faith to come through. And it was in this time, which is a big part of the study of the book of Ezra that we get to see. Well, Haggai and Zechariah were used by God to encourage them to continue to do God's work through these temptations that they were under. And so their leaders, their two leaders, main leaders, Zerubbabel and Joshua, were prominent in that too. So these are two that come up a lot in Ezra. We see them in Nehemiah and in Haggai and Zechariah. So we're really not going to understand Haggai and Zechariah if we don't understand how that ties into the books of Ezra and a little bit of Nehemiah also. When we get to chapter 5, just to mention this now, and the first verse of Ezra chapter 5 says, "Then the prophets Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo prophesied unto the Jews that were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel, even unto them." And then it mentions Zerubbabel and Joshua immediately after that in chapter 5, in the very next verse. So Haggai and Zechariah are mentioned here in the book of Ezra, that they're there being used by God in this. And so we see that in the books themselves that bear the names of those two prophets. But Zerubbabel and Joshua, we see these two over and over again, especially here. Well, who are they? The first one that's mentioned in chapter 2, verse 2, as the leader is Zerubbabel. The first one that's mentioned in chapter 3, verse 2, is Joshua. They're identified by their fathers and who they are, and we can see from the scriptures then what their role was. So since we read Joshua's name first here, it says in verse 2, "Then stood up," chapter 3, verse 2 here in Ezra, "Then stood up Joshua the son of Jozadak, and his brethren," whom? The priests. "And Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel, and his brethren." So here we have those two leaders. Joshua the son of Jozadak, and his brethren the priests. So who is Joshua? This Joshua. We can deduce what was the origin of his name. I mean, if you're named, you can figure out the origin of a lot of the names of these different ones. Different ones we read about in the scriptures that were Jews. Well, even who's the apostle that God used to write the more books than anybody else in the New Testament? Paul. What was his, he came to be called Paul, but early on, I mean, we first read about him, he is Saul of Tarsus. What tribe was he from? Tribe of Benjamin. Well, anybody that was of the tribe of Benjamin that's named Saul, what's the origin of that name? What king was from Benjamin that had that name? I mean, obviously, that goes back to King Saul. So even all the way to the time of where you get to the first century A.D., Benjamites are still being named after the one king that came from their tribe. Well, Joshua. I mean, that's a very prominent Israelite name. But why is that so? I mean, obviously, what's the origin of that? This is Joshua the high priest, but who do you think he was named for? I mean, Joshua, the judge of Israel that led the conquering of the land of Canaan. And by the way, I mean, that's the same name that who else has that we have the, I guess, more of the Aramaic form of? Jesus. I mean, that's really what his name is. So this is that's a prominent name, obviously, and one that receives much honor from the Lord. So this Joshua, though, this isn't obviously the Joshua that we read about from the book of Joshua that was around and became the leader of the Israelites after Moses. This is Joshua, the son of Jozadak. He's the high priest. All right, so we read about the genealogy of the Levites in 1 Chronicles chapter 6. So keep a mark here. Since he's identifying the genealogies, it's good for us to see this and who these ones are. So he starts in 1 Chronicles chapter 6, the sons of Levi, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. So those are the three sons of Levi. So all the Levites were descended through one of those three sons. And the families, those three families, their descendants, they were organized by family and given particular jobs to do in the service of the Lord. The Lord was their inheritance. The Lord was the inheritance of the tribe of Levi. So we actually went through that a little bit last week when we were looking at their work and then how those Nethinims were working under them. But the Levites, they had the work of the Lord to do and assisting their brethren who were the priests of the Lord. But God gave different jobs for the families that descended from Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. When he mentions the sons of Kohath in verse 2, he says, and the sons of Kohath, Amram, Izhar, and Hebron, and Uzziel, and the children of Amram, Aaron and Moses and Miriam. The sons also of Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar. So of those three sons of Levi, which of those three sons of Levi did Moses and Aaron descend from, and their sister Miriam, obviously? Kohath, because Kohath was the father of Amram, it says, and the children of Amram were Aaron and Moses and Miriam. And then it traces from there. So you have Levi, you have Kohath, Amram, and Aaron. And then Aaron had four sons. So all and only the sons of Aaron could be priests. So do we then deduce that, well, all the priests, therefore, were descendants of those four sons of, this is a trick question, by the way, of those four sons of Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar? Well, that's partly correct. except for the problem is with the first two, Nadab and Abihu. What happened to them in Leviticus chapter 10, verses 1 and 2, if you want to read about it? Yeah, they got burnt up. They offered some strange fire before the Lord, and so the Lord gave some of his own fire back. He burned them up. So they died on the spot for doing something that God did not authorize. Again, there's another lesson about the authority of God. He told them what kind of offering to make, and they offered something that God had not commanded. So they came up with something and said, here, Lord, this is for you. But it's not what he told them to offer, and when they made up their own thing that was not what God had told them to do, then God demonstrated that that was not acceptable. So they were killed. And it tells us that they did not bear any children. So they died before they had children. So there were no descendants of Aaron through Nadab and Abihu, which means all the priests, therefore, came through Aaron through one of the other two sons that he had, Eleazar and Ithamar. Now, which family of priests that were the high priests we read about Eleazar and his son Phinehas, and that's mentioned in verse 4 here in 1 Chronicles 6. They are ones that we read about through the time of Moses and Joshua. They were there through all of that. Phinehas was there really as a contemporary of Joshua and Caleb. So we read about Eleazar and Phinehas, as well as Aaron, of course, in the books of Exodus through Deuteronomy and then Joshua. Even a little bit in Judges. But then the high priest after that, we don't keep reading about the direct descendants of those ones. The next family of priests that we read about that was serving as the high priest, we get to the end of the period of the judges at the beginning of the book of 1 Samuel. And who's the high priest in Israel at the time when Samuel the prophet and the last judge of Israel was born? Eli. And Eli, the priest, we learned that his family was descended through Ithamar. So he was not from the ones that were through Eleazar, the son of Aaron. In 1 Chronicles chapter 24, briefly, it says, "Now these are the divisions of the sons of Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar. But Nadab and Abihu died before their father and had no children. Therefore Eleazar and Ithamar executed the priest's office. And David distributed them, both of Zadok of the sons of Eleazar and Ahimelech of the sons of Ithamar, according to their offices in their service." Ahimelech was the lone survivor after the massacre of the priests at Nob by King Saul that was carried out by Doeg the Edomite. At the time when Saul was pursuing after David and after he was given help, Ahimelech gave him assistance. Abiathar was his son that was the sole survivor, actually. When we read about the massacre of those priests at Nob and this one that's left of their family, these are of the house of Eli. And it tells us right there that Ahimelech was of the sons of Ithamar. So the house of Eli descended through Ithamar. So the high priesthood, at some point, it shifted from Eleazar and Phinehas, so from Aaron's descendants through through Eleazar, it shifted over to the descendants of Ithamar. as far as the high priesthood. Now, the descendants of Ithamar and of Eleazar through Phinehas, or Eleazar through all of his sons, all of them were priests. But the high priesthood, it shifted somewhere from Eleazar's descendants to Ithamar's through Eli. But when God executed judgment on the house of Eli because he did not restrain his wicked sons, the priesthood shifted and was given to another family. Hophni and Phinehas were the two wicked sons of Eli, but they were destroyed, and then the house of Eli was ultimately destroyed by what God proclaimed. And so then the high priesthood shifted to another one. It was given to Zadok, that's mentioned here. And Zadok was a descendant of whom? Well, it says they're both Zadok of the sons of Eleazar. So it shifted back there. Now, one of the things that we see in 1 Chronicles chapter 6, when it's giving the genealogy of the priests here, back in 1 Chronicles 6 and verse 4, it says Eleazar begat Phinehas, Phinehas begat Abishua, and so it's tracing his lineage, but then it gets down to verse 7, Meraioth begat Amariah, and Amariah begat Ahitub, and Ahitub begat Zadok, and Zadok begat Ahimeas, and so there's that Zadok who was there at the time of David and Solomon, and Zadok became high priest in the days of Solomon. But then it traces Zadok's descendants, because he was the one that was given the high priesthood as a faithful man by God to replace the house of Eli. And so then verse 9 says, and Ahimeaz begat Azariah, and Azariah begat Johanan, and Johanan begat Azariah. He it is that executed the priest's office in the temple that Solomon built in Jerusalem. And Azariah begat Amariah, and Amariah begat Ahitub, and Ahitub begat Zadok. So here's another Zadok. And Zadok begat Shalom, and Shalom begat Hilkiah, and Hilkiah begat Azariah. Now Hilkiah, we read about, he's known as, he was the one that did what? In Josiah's time. He found the law of the Lord in the temple. After it had been lost. So then that got reinstituted. And Azariah begat Saraiah, and Saraiah begat Jehozadak. And Jehozadak went into captivity when the Lord carried away Judah and Jerusalem by the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. So this is Jehozadak, and it's his son Joshua that's the high priest now that we're reading about in Ezra chapter 3, verse 2, and also the rest of Ezra and in Haggai and Zechariah the prophets. So therefore, as we would expect, this shows by genealogy, this Joshua the high priest, he was a descendant of whom? He was a descendant of Zadok, who was a descendant of Eleazar, the son of Aaron. So when the priesthood shifted to the house of Zadok, that happened under Solomon, all the way down through the captivity and the return of the captives, the high priesthood is still in that family. So it has endured when it went from the house of Eli to the house of Zadok. The direct descendants from that Zadok, I mean, they're still serving as a high priest all the way here to the return of the captives. That covers a lot of time, doesn't it? I mean, that covers the next to Saul and David, it covers the rest of the time of the kings of Judah, and then also the 70-year captivity, and now after they've returned. So this has endured for some more than 500 years as the dynasty of the high priests here. So when God shifted that high priesthood to the house of Zadok, that was a decision he made, and that endured as far as we know and as far as the record is given, it endures for the rest of the Old Testament period. Very, very interesting. We get to the New Testament time and we read about Annas and Caiaphas and those ones who'd become Sadducees. We don't have the direct connection anymore, but as far as the house of Zadok in the Old Testament to the end of the what we have the record of in the Old Testament books, the high priesthood persists there. So it's interesting to see that connection here when he identifies Joshua as the son of Josadak. So when we read about somebody as the son of, we need to pay attention to it because they're very often is something very relevant to that, as there is with the next one there. So Joshua is the high priest, and so it mentions he and his brethren, the priests. So that's why he's a prominent leader. So this is the high priest of Israel now. And Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel. Well, Shealtiel, who is he? Well, this is also an important name that we have. Shealtiel is one that is actually the son of Jehoiachin, also known as Jeconiah or Coniah, who was the king of Judah that was taken over with the captives when they went to Babylon. So now we're looking at descendant. So this would be a descendant of Jeconiah, who was the former king. So then Zerubbabel is actually a descendant of whom? We trace his lineage. If he's the son of Shealtiel, who was the son of Jeconiah, then what does that tell us about who Zerubbabel is in terms of his lineage? Yes, he's from David through the royal line. He is. He's of the royal household, and here he is now coming back. Now this is something also to keep in mind when Jehoiachin was taken from the throne at 18 years old and taken to Babylon, where he remained for many, many more years. And he was there in the palace of the kings of Babylon for the rest of the empire there. So we know he was there for several more decades at least. And then he was taken and was made to be chief among all the kings that had been taken captives by the Babylonians of all the kingdoms they had conquered. And sat at the table with their kings. So he was given a very prominent position. I mean, he would have most certainly had contact, would have been right where Daniel the prophet was, serving in the capacity of in the royal court. So the question, and we mentioned this at the time when we were reading about him, which we don't have a firm answer to as far as Jehoiachin himself, did he repent? Did he become converted away from his wicked ways, being the son of that very wicked Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, and he was involved in wickedness from his youth, as we read about when we were studying about him. And by the way, you can read about in another part of the genealogies in First Chronicles. In chapter 3, it gives the descendants of David, the royal line, and Jeconiah and Shealtiel are mentioned in verse 17 of that that chapter, and Shealtiel's identified there as the son of Jeconiah. So that's also included, most importantly, in the genealogy of Christ in Matthew chapter 1. So in the Gospel of Matthew chapter 1, so this is the New Testament begins with this. The New Testament begins, the first verse of the book of Matthew is the book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. So the declaration of the New Testament, its opening statement, is about Jesus, that he is the Christ. He's the anointed one. He is the king. And as such, to be the Christ, does he have to be descended from? Well, obviously two individuals, David and Abraham. And so that's the first verse of the New Testament declaring the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. And it starts with the genealogy of Abraham, traces that down to David. And so in verse 5, it says, "And Salmon begat Boaz of Rahab, and Boaz begat Obed of Ruth, and Obed begat Jesse." Well, there two of the great women of the Old Testament. We have, when we have in the book of James in chapter 2, when he gives two specific examples, they're obviously not the only two that exist. We have many, but the two, he brings up two in James 2 of examples of a living faith. Abraham, and who's the other one that he mentions in James 2? Rahab. She was from Jericho, had been a harlot, but she's the one that hid the spies on the roof, and she ended up becoming part of the nation of Israel with her family. She was brought in there, and she married Salmon, and Boaz was a descendant through Abraham, through Judah, through Rahab. Well, who's another very prominent? So if you think about two women of the Old Testament that became part of the nation of Israel that were actually foreigners in terms of their birth, well, you have Rahab, who was from Jericho of the land of Canaan, and you have Ruth, who was a Moabitess. And Ruth, of course, we have the book of Ruth that tells that, gives that account and who she was and how she became married to Obed, and she begat Jesse, begat Obed of Boaz, and then Jesse was Ruth's grandson. David was the great-grandson of Ruth. So both Rahab and Ruth, those two women that were born afar, who became part of the Israelite nation as they had great faith in God, I mean, two of the great women of the Old Testament. They're both in the lineage of Christ, and they're mentioned by name there in Matthew 1. But then from there, it says in verse 6, Jesse begat David the king, and David the king begat Solomon of her that had been the wife of Uriah. And Solomon begat Rehoboam. And so then it traces from Rehoboam all the way down to Josiah at the end of verse 10. And verse 11 says, "And Josiah begat Jeconiah and his brethren about the time they were carried away to Babylon. And after they were brought to Babylon, Jeconiah begat Shealtiel. And Shealtiel begat Zerubbabel." And then it traces from Zerubbabel down to whom? All the way down to Jacob at the end of verse 15. "And Jacob begat Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, who is called Christ." So that is establishing Jesus as a descendant from Abraham through of the tribe of Judah, through David, and not just through David, but through the royal line. It's establishing Christ as being the rightful heir to David's throne. And who's mentioned there in his lineage? Well, there's Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, who was of the royal household. And this is that Zerubbabel we're reading about here. Now, Zerubbabel, as we see, he's a leader of these captives coming back to the land of Israel. Joshua and Zerubbabel are two very righteous men. Well, Zerubbabel's grandfather, who had been the king at the time when he was a young man, when he was taken into captivity, he was not righteous. Neither were the rest of those ones that were taken over there with them that the Lord preserved as a basket of good figs, and he converted through the work of Ezekiel. But what about Jeconiah himself? Well, we're not told. Was he a good fig? Did he come to repentance? Well, we don't know if he did or if it was his son Shealtiel. But somewhere between in the captivity in Babylon, between Jeconiah and Zerubbabel, Zerubbabel's a righteous man. So there is a conversion that occurs somewhere in there. And we could hope that it was Jeconiah, that Shealtiel, his son, was righteous also. We don't know the answers to that, but we do know by the time you get to Zerubbabel, when his father was taken away from his grandfather was taken away from the throne at 18 years old, he was doing wickedly. But now when Zerubbabel comes back from the captivity as their leader, and he serves as the governor of the people, he's their ruler. So he's their judge, their ruler, and Joshua is the high priest. And so they're the two leaders of the people, and they're righteous. And so that's where we're going to see them so prominently here. And the first work that we're told that they did there was, when they all gather at Jerusalem, they build the altar so that they can offer the burnt offerings thereon, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. So there were the daily sacrifices and those things. They're going to rebuild the temple, but what structure did they build first, and why? The altar, so that they could immediately start obeying those commandments of God. I mean, why delay the building of the altar until the temple is completed? Then that would just put off. There were certain commandments they couldn't obey until the temple was rebuilt. We can get to that later, Lord willing. But the commandments that involved the altar, you didn't have to have the temple completed before doing that. And so they start first with what they could do, so they could obey whatever commands they could to start with. So they got the sequence right, and then the priorities right. Their priority is to obey the commandments of the Lord, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. That's what they're seeking to do. So we'll get back to that some more, Lord willing, next week in our study. And as we see, they will start to lay the foundation of the temple to begin its rebuilding. But let's go to our Heavenly Father again in prayer as we close.